electrical ones? I think
yes, sir. Yes, sir. Sir, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Can you state your full name and ADC number for the record?
My name is Miguel Berro Terran, 076611.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for a 31-412-8 parole hearing to consider regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. I'd like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. You cannot see us as this is a telephonic hearing, but I will certainly introduce you to the members. We have sitting on the bench the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson, the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse, our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright, the Honorable Mr. David Neal, and my name is Louis Quinones. I'll be serving as the panel chairman for this hearing. I'll begin the hearing with a summary. Because it was written Miguel in our packet, and I want to make sure that I was saying it. Yeah, it's Miguel on the blue sheet. Okay. Miguel Berro Terran, ADC number 076611. He's 53 years old. He was certified eligible by the Arizona Department of Corrections for 31-412-A, regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. The crime of conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree incurred inside the Department of Corrections on or about June 13, 1990. He was approximately 25 years old at the time of the instant offense. Is this correct so far, Mr. Berro Terran?
Yes.
And pardon me if I pronounce your name later in the hearing a little more in the English tradition, just for the sake of my fellow board members. And I have to admit, for my last name being Quinones, you have a very challenging last name.
You can call me Bertrand. That's the English version.
Okay. Bertrand?
Yeah, good. I'm used to it after all these years in prison.
Believe me, I'm used to it with the last name Quinones as well, so I hear you. You were found guilty by jury trial on March 27, 1991, and sentenced on April 29, 1991. You will be parole eligible effective June 5, 2018. Berro Terran was already serving 5.25 year prison sentence for narcotics conspiracy at the time of the instant offense. And it should be noted that the crime in question represented a serious escalation in violent behavior. I'll read a short summary of the offense in question from the pre-sentence report. On June 13, 1990, Mr. Berro Terran, the two co-defendants, and the victim were in an outdoor exercise area at the Department of Corrections Wilmot facility located at the 10,000 block of South Wilmot Road, Tucson, Arizona. Mr. Berro Terran was on a basketball, or pardon me, the victim was on a basketball court adjacent to a weightlifting area. Mr. Berro Terran and co-defendant Vasquez were in the weightlifting area exercising. Co-defendant Gaitan spoke to the victim and walked him over to the weight area. Mr. Berro Terran had a weight bar which weighed approximately 35 pounds across his shoulder. He was doing an exercise called a twist. The victim and Gaitan had just passed Mr. Berro Terran when he lifted the weight bar and struck the victim in the back of the head with it. The victim fell to the ground. Defendant Vasquez stepped forward with a second weight bar and struck him again. The entire incident was taped on closed circuit camera, which was focused on the recreation yard at the time of the instant offense and witnessed by a correction officer. So that's just a summary of the offense. According to Mr. Berro Terran's institutional progress report, he's had an impressive amount of programming in ADC through 2017. He has a release plan, which includes, pursuing employment, his GED, and support from out-of-state family members. But we have no address for acceptance at a halfway house, at least not that I recognized in the parole packet that was given to me. So if there is, we can talk about that. He has had moderate discipline at ADC from 1990 to 2013, with his last major on October 24, 2012, for promoting prison contraband. There was another ticket for prison contraband in 2013, but I believe that was dropped. This appears to be his fourth hearing before the board. He has letters of support in his portal packet from family and community members. So, Mr. Bergeron, this is your first time before this board. We'd like to get to know you. Can you tell us about the offense that resulted in your incarceration and your later parole revocation?
Are you talking about what eventually brought me to prison?
No, I'm sorry, I made a mistake here. I meant to say just the offense that resulted in your incarceration, because if I'm not mistaken, you were inside the Department of Corrections for a narcotics violation, and this murder happened while you were an inmate, correct?
Yes.
Pardon me. Thank you for helping me get oriented. But again, this is your first time before this board. We'd like to get to know you. So can you tell us about the offense that resulted in your incarceration, in particular your murder sentence?
Okay, well, coming to prison, as you mentioned, and I was in prison for conspiracy and possession of dangerous narcotics. Do you want me to go back there and what brought me to prison on this?
Yeah, I think we don't have to spend a lot of time there, but it helps to understand why you were in prison in the first place.
Okay, I got into debt. I could no longer pay my bills. I was working for Butler Southeast Roofing Company. I just couldn't match my bills, and I got introduced to selling drugs. At the time, I wasn't using drugs. I thought it was a quick way to make money, and obviously it was a bad decision on my part, and ultimately got arrested for it. I thought I could make a fast buck and you know, pay my bills with that. In between all of that, I'm trying to remember. It's been so long. That's what precipitated the whole thing was. I had an opportunity to make a fast buck, which turned into a fast buck, and then I thought, well, that was easy. I can do it again, and ultimately did it again, and this time without, you know, obviously you never know, but I sold to a police officer, a detective, and that's what brought me to prison was selling to a police officer. We were selling 2 kilos of cocaine, and ultimately what they charged me with was 500 grams because a little over a kilo and a half was destroyed, and that's what ultimately brought me to prison. I fought my sentence from 22 years to 14 years. Which ultimately they left that. They sentenced me to 14 hard. I acquired a new attorney. I think his name was Jesse Miranda, and he was able to get me a deal to 5 1/4 years soft. And that's what I entered the prison system with. At the time that I had actually entered, from the time that I got arrested in 87 to the point that I actually entered the system in 89, because of that time, I literally entered the system with probably, I want to say, less than a year, maybe a year, less than a year, but maybe 9 months to go home. And that's what brought me to prison. Do you want me to keep going?
Sure. And then we can move along to the event that led to your conspiracy to commit murder conviction.
Okay. And then, well, upon my arrival to prison, as soon as I got here, I was ordered by the court in my first sentence to program. Specifically, they wanted certain types of programming, you know, anger management, which I completed. They wanted me to take an NA class, which I completed. I wound up subsequently taking a AA class as well, although it wasn't recommended by the course. I still took it anyhow, and I took some parenting classes. because my term is a prison. I wound up leaving a 14-month and a 3-year-old, a 14-month-old year son and a 3-year-old daughter out there. And so I took some parenting classes. I took some anger management, some victims awareness classes. I sat in on some groups where I was able to, through those groups, I learned it was called a mentoring program, where I was able to get up and mentor other people based on what I was learning, and encourage others not to make the same mistake that I made coming to prison. That was it. I had just signed my papers to leave San Juan. I arrived to prison as a 4-3. Was scheduled to go to recon. Wound up getting the ticket, and they moved me from a 4-3 to a 4-4, and that sent me to San Juan. And when I got to San Juan, everything was fine. I was programming. I was going to school. I was going to GED. I was working. I used to work in the kitchen. I worked on the gun gang, and then that was it. After that, do you want me to go into this, the about the 25 to license?
Well, yeah, I guess one of the questions I'm going to have once we get into it.
Well, if you want to ask any questions on what I had just spoke on, what brought me to prison.
Well, yeah, good question. Where were you arrested for the narcotics violation?
I was originally arrested back in September of 87. And then I was able to bond out for a little while. I was out for a hot minute while I was fighting my case, going back and forth to court. Going back and forth to court. I guess when they determined that I was going to have to do time is when they revoked my bond and I went to the county jail.
Where were you arrested? Which jurisdiction?
In Maricopa County.
Oh, Maricopa County. It wasn't in Tucson.
Yeah, the offense happened in Mesa, Arizona. That's where I'm from. I reside in Mesa, Arizona. That's where the offense happened. But where I was tried and convicted was in Maricopa County, which that's all Maricopa County, but that was in Phoenix.
And when you said 500 grams, did you mean 500 grams of cocaine? Or
I was selling cocaine at the time. I've never sold any other kind of drug before. That was the only thing. And it was 2 kilos of cocaine.
Okay, we'll discuss the incident that happened inside the prison system, and I'll begin by saying usually I'll say I and we, the board, are careful when it comes to STG, because we recognize it can be sensitive as far as prison politics are concerned. But was this incident related to being involved in prison politics?
No. You're talking about the incident that picking up the license?
Yes.
No, not at all. To be quite honest, it was a stupid reason. What I'm about to say is going to sound really stupid and petty, but again, you mentioned prison politics, and if you understand prison politics, it's kind of like you don't touch another man's property. It was actually over a cup of coffee.
Yes, sir?
I'm sorry?
Yes, I was going to say, if you'll continue.
Oh yeah, it was over a cup of coffee. A cup of coffee was thrown in my face, and that was the disrespect. And it was black versus Mexican. At that time, there was a lot of. There's always been racial tension in prison, and I'm certainly not minimizing anything. But at that time, even more so, coming through the counties back then. It was just ongoing struggle between the our race and the Mexican race, the black race. And at that time, it was kind of like, San Juan was known as Gladiator School, and pretty much everybody that got there, that was kind of like was ever going to learn to do the time there. From there, everything else was going to fall into line. And yeah, I unfortunately got burned. I got a hot cup of coffee thrown in my face and burned. And so my payback was to strike out at the inmate that threw the coffee in my face.
Well, I'll ask again, though, because there's quite a bit of information in Ames. Were you affiliated with one of the gangs?
Yes, I am. I am today affiliated with a gang. At the time, I was not affiliated with a gang, nor was the incident that took place as they say in prison, to catch up. I know that they tried to use that in my trial. They tried to bring it out in trial, but it wasn't true. It had no legs, and eventually they didn't use it against me because, like I said, it just wasn't the case. But it did come up. They tried to say that that's why I did it, but that was not the case at all. Neither for myself or the other inmate that was tried with me, which was inmate Raymond Gaitan. Neither one of us were gang members before. And we didn't do it for any gang affiliation or anything inside prison.
And I think some of what you said speaks to why, at least for me, I tend to be a little bit sensitive about STG intel.
Yes.
Because we don't always know how accurate it is, or sometimes it's just friendships. We don't know. It's not like... that is a charge in and of itself. You know, we're here specifically for the conspiracy to commit murder case and to see where you're at in your rehabilitation, right? You know, how you've evolved. I'll kind of close up on that by asking, because there seems to be some notes in here, did you step down from that
role? I entered the step-down program in... I entered the program in 2008, and that program is you have to do 2 years gang-free activity, and then and that went on to 2010. I was actually put into the program, and that's an 18-month program where you have, once you enter, they move you out of Wing 4 here where I'm at in Mason Wing 2 in Browning Unit. Wing 4 is where they keep all the gang members. That's where I was at the time. Once you actually enter the program, what they want you to do is, let me back up for a second.
Sure.
They want you to give them 24 months of gang-free activity. That's while being in Wing 4. That's where they have all the STG members. Okay? Then if you do that successfully, then they'll put your name on the list. And when your name comes up, they'll enter you into the actual program where they move you out of Wing 4 and they move you to Wing 1 where the step-down program begins. And they have three phases. They got Pod 1, Pod 2, and Pod 3. Each pod is a separate phase. Pod 1, you have to do 6 months of programming and you're still locked down as if I was in Wing 4. When I pass that phase, ticket-free programming and going through all of the criteria that's presented to us to succeed, they'll move you to phase two of the program. They'll literally move you from pod one to pod two. Once you get to pod two, you continue to program and go to school. You continue to do everything that they ask of you to do, except you have two extra freedoms that they give you, and that is that you get to walk to the red pen without the handcuffs, and you get to walk to the shower without handcuffs. Now, this is when I entered the program. Since then, as I speak to you, it's changed a little bit. They give you a little bit more freedom. But I'm coming to you from when I entered the program back in 2010. We could walk to the shower and to the red pen without handcuffs. Once I passed that phase, I entered pod three, which is the last phase. I had to do 6 months there. And that 6 months was, I had, again, continue the program, go to school. We had to do a psychologist came in and talked to us. I had to get polygraphed, which I passed. Some of the questions on the polygraph test, five main questions are, have you been ordered to commit assault or any violence towards staff or inmates? Have you been given orders to facilitate any type of illicit drugs or drug sales? See, what were some of the other ones? Why are you in the program? Do you plan on making the program succeed for you? Those kind of questions. I don't remember every one of them, but those are, I think those are three or four of them. There were five major questions, and those are some of the questions. Well, I passed all of those on the polygraph test, and I successfully completed the program, and then I entered, from there, I was sent to Tucson, where I participated fully in the program.
So are you still in the program, sir?
I am and I'm not. I stepped out of the program because I wanted, one, two reasons. One, I knew I was coming to the parole board and I was hoping to get parole action. And two, because I was doing less time and I didn't want to do that 2 years again, I stepped back so someone else could go into the program, one. And then two is I didn't want to risk being in a situation where anything could happen or put myself in a situation where I could get in any more trouble or trouble come my way. And so I just stepped out. I'm still programming. I'm still in school. I'm still doing outside work. I got not a full-time job, I shouldn't say. But I got a job. I work every day, 7 days a week. Ticket-free. Of course, everything I mentioned to you is based on the fact that I'm ticket-free. The fact that I'm able to go to programming, literally leave my cell and go to a classroom setting, you have to be ticket-free. But those are based on phases as well, phase one, two, and three. I'm a phase three. I'm the highest year that you can go. I continue to work on my... I guess what, in my words, my rehabilitation, everything that I feel necessary that I have to do or the changes that I need to make to succeed, hopefully, in getting out of prison. And then, of course, whatever DOC offers, and by way of programming, I participate fully. I've completed, as you stated earlier. I've completed a lot of programming. I've taken everything that you possibly can take in here. If they offer anything else, then I'm willing to take that as well.
Can I ask you a quick question? This is not a dig, because I am impressed with how much programming you've taken. But has it been difficult for you to get acceptance into a GED program? Because it sounds like something you haven't done yet. Is that right?
No, I took my GED the GED five tests. I took my GED in 2012, and I passed the first four tests. I didn't pass it on the math test. So in 2014, when I came, this was in 2012. In 2012, when I came back here for a hot minute, They retested me on my math, and I didn't pass my math. So that's where I stand today. I'm still working on that. But I didn't pass my math. I took it once as a juvenile, a young man. I took my GED back then. And again, unfortunately, I didn't pass it on my math test either. And then again, in 2012, I didn't pass it again. And that's where I'm at. I'm still working on it today. But that's the only thing that I haven't absolutely... I want to use the word conquer here because it's been pretty difficult for me. I've never been good with numbers. And I was just telling one of my best friends the other day, he was telling me about a potential job. And I was saying, well, the only problem I have is a measuring tape. Well, measuring tapes, you know, numbers.
I'm laughing at you, but I appreciate you asking.
Yeah, and that's been one of my problems is numbers. So that's where I'm at there as far as my GED is. But I absolutely want to get my GED, whether it's here or I'm able to continue that out in the streets. One of my goals is, if at all possible, and it is based on getting my GED, is hopefully to take a sociology class there at MCC or wherever I land at, because it's one of the ways that I took a reentry class, just so you know. And in that reentry class, they had advised us of some of the classes that we could take, and some of the classes that interest me was sociology, because there you have to be licensed to get a counseling job, and that's what I'd like to do. I want to if possible, I would like to use my experience of incarceration, of gang affiliation, of being a knucklehead, pretty near on my life, and using those things and as an example to those that are on that path, and hopefully detour them or give them something to think about, you know, some of the tools that I didn't have. If I can say this, some of the conclusions that I've come to is I think I want to make it clear that I take responsibility for my actions then, what brought me to prison, and thereafter. I don't call them mistakes, because mistakes are accidents, and I made the conscious decisions to do all the things that I did, whether it was selling drugs or coming to prison and striking out as an inmate. And with that said, some of the conclusions that I've come to is that I would like to share with others, and that I've come to is courage. I just didn't have the courage to do the right thing. I was a people pleaser, and I come to the conclusion that, you know, you know, not to be cliche here, but you can't, you know, that old thing about pleasing people some of the time, but not all of the time. People are just never pleased with anything, and the more you give them, the more they want, and that was my problem. I didn't have the courage to take a stand and do the right thing, to make better decisions. Those are the things that I regret, that I didn't have the tools, the courage, and the skills to make better decisions. And I take full responsibility for that. It has nothing to do with how I was raised or not raised, or any affiliations to religion or non-religion, anything. I just didn't have the skills. I knew right from wrong. I'm a grown man, obviously. My father told me once, he says, being born a male doesn't entitle you to be a man. I never understood that. Today I understand that. But I didn't at the time. Obviously in hindsight, you wish you didn't make the mistakes that you made. You wish you didn't make the decisions that you made. But I guess the good thing about that is that as I speak to you, obviously I'm alive, I'm well, my heart is beating, my mind is alert, and I got breath in my lungs. And so with that said, every day I've had an opportunity to learn, to reflect on what I've been through, what I've gone through, and what I'm going through. I've absolutely looked into my actions and the inmate that I struck out at, Mr. James Woods. I attempted to contact him, wasn't able to, DOC didn't allow me to. I went through the courts, was unsuccessful in 2008, taking responsibility for myself. I finally came to the conclusion that I had to be honest with myself and the courts. I wrote Mr. Gaetan's attorney, told him that I wanted to help his client, and in 2008, I wound up testifying for the inmate Gaetan, and I told the whole truth against to my own peril. I told the truth and took full responsibility for my actions. The inmate Gaetan was innocent in the fact that he didn't know what was going to take place. I did. He didn't. I lied to him. I used him. And because of it, he wound up with a life sentence. And because of my testimony, he's now out. He got out. And it took me a long time to come to this conclusion. So I was also advised by counsel, obviously, to exhaust all of the remedies yourself, and I did. But once I did, then I went ahead and I did the right thing. I, at least according, it made me feel better inside. I made that step to tell him the course of the truth. And of course, the prosecutor came at me with, well, you're just doing it because, you know, you're trying to help your friend out. Well, I guess in some cases you could look at it that way, but that wasn't the case here. One, I didn't know inmate Gaetan before this, and two, for the last 25 years, I had no contact with him, and there was no proof of me having any contact with him. And once they came to that resolve, I guess they did what they did, and to my knowledge, he's out there on the streets, and whether he's doing well or not, I don't know. I didn't have contact with him.
If I may ask you just a few more questions before asking the fellow board members if they have questions for you. One
is that you did have a major in 2012 for prison contraband. So can you talk to us about that?
Okay, so I'm sorry, repeat that?
You received a major ticket in October of 2012 for promoting prison contraband, is that correct?
Yes, okay. All right, if you recall, I told you that in 2012, I took my GED, and for a hot minute, they brought me back over here to Florence, Lyman Unit. Okay, what happened there was, the reason that brought me back was because originally, when the program first started, it was started off in Lyman Unit. And the program back then, because it was brand new to DOC, they had a filling out point. And if you got in trouble, if somehow you got a ticket, if you got in trouble, maybe you got a dirty UA, maybe you were caught with a cell phone, maybe you got in a fight, whatever. What they would do is they would bring you back over here. You would go through the motions of, you know, through whatever the infraction was. And then once you were done, they would send you back to the yard. Okay, so by the time, and this was back when the program started in 2006. So by the time I'm getting into the program in 2008, it was explained to us at that time that no longer there was going to be zero tolerance for anything, and that we had to fly by the rules. I mean, we had to play by the rules wholeheartedly, and that there was no, you know, there was not going to be any excuses. Okay, so now with that said, one of the things that came up was, okay, well, now that we're going back to the yard after all of these years in lockdown, obviously we're going to have a Sally. How do I know what he's doing? I don't know what's in his head. I don't know what he brings into the cell. And it was explained to us at that time. It says, hey, look, man, you're not stupid. You know, being who you are, you know what's in your cell and what's not in your cell. So therefore, we're going to hold you accountable to whatever's in that cell. Okay, so now with all of that, preface there, I believe it was October 17th, 2012, I believe it was, during a shakedown, a TSU targeted shakedown, they found a cell phone in a common area in my cell. And because I'm the STG member on the step down program, and as I zero tolerance, I was removed. My Shelby stayed. Ultimately, he filed an affidavit taking responsibility for the cell phone, but it was way after the fact. At the moment that they removed me, they put me on report. I want to say 15 days later, I went to before the captain. They found me guilty of promoting prison contraband, and subsequently sent me back to Iron Unit. I told you I came back over here for a hot minute, and I finished I took my GED math test. Well, what happened was there was I filed an appeal. I took responsibility for the ticket because I was guilty of absolutely allowing that in my cell. But with that said, I filed an appeal, and I won the appeal because what they were supposed to do for the program and policy was they weren't supposed to handle it the way they did. They should have left me there. I would have done my whole time, my 30 days LOP, and then went back into the program. But because they didn't do it that way, they subsequently reinstated me back into the program, and then I went back to the yard. I went back to Tucson.
Okay, sir. I'm
going to
ask my fellow board members any questions for you.
Excuse me, 1 second. Let me blow my nose, please.
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you, Mr. Turan. Yes, Mr. Johnson.
So I just have one question. Maybe I missed part of it, but what's your STG involvement when this incident occurred?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
What's your involvement with the STG when this incident occurred?
What's my STG affiliation?
Yes, sir. When this incident occurred, that you currently in on?
I was STG'd in, 2000 and I was originally STG'd in 1994. In Winslow,
okay,
Kaibab South. That program ultimately went under review and was suspended, so I remained in Winslow. And then in 1995, I was STG'd under a new program that itself again was suspended because it was pending review. In And then in October of 95, they created a new program, and they sent me from, at that time, SMU2, or SMU1, which back then we called CBA, and they sent me to this bed where I'm at now, which is, at that time was SMU2, now it's Browning Unit, because this building had just opened up, and this is what's going to be the new Supermax. And they brought me here in February 6, 1996, where I remained. And then in 1997, that program again was suspended, and pending review, they allowed all of us out to Central Unit. This was in 1997. I want to say roughly somewhere in, the end of May, somewhere in June. And I was out there for 40 days until July 31st, 1997, where they re-STG'd me for the last time, brought me back over here, and everyone else that went with us, they pretty much released the whole building, because, or at least everybody that was STG'd. And they re-STG'd me on July 31st specifically, brought me back over here, and I've been here ever since. Okay. That was February 6, 1996.
So what was your affiliation?
I'm sorry?
What was your affiliation, sir?
I'm not understanding the question.
I guess directly with gang.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I can barely hear you. I'm SDG of Mexican Mafia.
Okay. So when this incident occurred in 1990, were you just trying to get prepared to get involved in that, or what was it? Did that have any influence?
I just got to prison, if you recall. So I wasn't affiliated with anybody. I can't tell you what was in my head or anything, other than the fact that I didn't make the right decisions. I didn't have the proper skills to say no, as they say, turn the other cheek. It was a pretty violent time. Unfortunately, at that time, violence begat violence. And it was one of the ways that, you resolved your issues, specifically when it came to another race. You guys used the word prison politics. Prison politics is real heavy in here, and it's thick. You can't breathe sometimes, it's so thick. And because of that, at that time, your actions have dictated that type of response. I don't even want to speak in hindsight because, I did what I did, and I can't tell you what I was thinking, because I don't remember. I know what I was feeling, and what I was feeling was anger. I think I was being led by pride. I would say today in hindsight, I guess it was misdirected pride. Being prideful for the wrong reason. My father, he was in Vietnam. He died last year, but he was in Vietnam, and he was my stepfather, and he used to always talk to me about pride. When you're a kid, ain't nobody trying to hear it. You learn your pride from the street. I can't tell you where that came from, because up until that point, me coming to prison, I didn't come to prison with any violence on my record. I didn't lash out at the police then. I didn't lash out at the police since. So it wasn't in my character as to, I have a history of this. But I think that I got caught up in the prison politics. I think I got up in just the way of the prison life in here, and what that, the terms in here are dictated by, and violence beget violence. You answer in here, violence with violence. But ultimately, that itself was I paid the greatest price for that in here, I guess, in the sense that since that time, absolutely, my life in prison hasn't been the same. At 31 years that I've been in prison, I've only actually been to 3 yards. It's almost like they get on a traveling circuit in here, and they've been to dang near every prison that there is in Arizona. And and that alone right there was enough to for DOC to put me in just, I guess, where they could keep a leash on me. That was the term they was used to towards me, and that's why I use it now. And they kept me where they could watch me. And I've only been to three. I've been to Sinon, Winslow, and I've been to Searcher Unit, and then I've been in this lockup ever since.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any further questions? Yes, Dr. Ray.
Yes, sir. Just one question, sir. Early on, when this hearing started, Honorable Mr. Kiwanis indicated that as part of your release plan, the possibility of your leaving the state of Arizona, but if you were released by this board on home arrest or whatever, what are your plans? Because more than likely you wouldn't be able to leave the state immediately, so what would be your plans here in Arizona, sir?
Well, I have two best friends that I consider family. All my family has since passed away. I literally, as they say, the last of the Mohicans. I got nobody. From the youngest to the oldest, everybody's gone. Mom, stepdad, everybody. Grandma, everybody's gone. So now with that said, I've had two of my best friends that have been in my life about 40 years. And they have stayed in my life since I've been in prison. They've done pretty much the prison time with me. They've stayed in contact with me. They've opened up a phone line, communication through letters, and they've encouraged me throughout the years. Now, with that said, if one of my best friends is sitting there with you, his name is Miguel Arasaga. His father, who I know as a kid, he's a deacon in one of the largest Catholic churches there here in Mesa, which is the Queen of Peace. He was also a teacher in the school district and a principal, retired and now full-time in the church. And I say all of that because even he is real heavy on education, on bettering yourself. And that's where, if possible, at least, I'll be going into his home.
Okay.
My best friend opened up his father's house to me with his father agreeing to that. I know in his home that I can get what I need as far as good influence, encouragement, and not discouragement. I'll be working. I have a job with Leroy himself, who's a supervisor for a construction company. I don't want to bring this up, but I'll bring it up now. I've studied since 1989. I've studied theology. I would like to say, speaking for myself, I'm well versed in theology. I've come a long way. That's been part of what's helped me come to a lot of the conclusions that I've come to. To make the decision that I made to walk away from the gang. I understand the repercussions of my actions and that it's an absolute death sentence. But I'm prepared to make that decision. I have two best friends that are going to help me make that transition, along with Leroy's father, who was a very dear friend of mine as well, and refers to me as Mijo. Mijo in Spanish for son in English. And I'm close to him. And they're going to give me the tools to help me succeed. Everything from my faith to working to making sure that I get to whatever programming that I can get programming and any kind of help thereafter. I've got them willing to extend a helping hand far more than I deserve. Everything from an automobile to a home. Work to trying to better my life.
I just have one other question, sir. I believe you stated earlier that one reason that you did not go any further in terms of the briefing was due to the fact that you were coming before this board. Did I understand you correct? Was that something that you stated, or did I misinterpret what you might have stated, sir?
You misinterpreted. What it is, to enter the step down program, you don't have to debrief. Remember I told you I took a polygraph test?
Yes, sir.
I've taken two polygraph tests. The schedule for a third polygraph test, if I wanted to, but I chose not to, because of the potential opportunity of parole. Now, with that said, you don't have to debrief. The only time that you have to debrief is what if you are leaving and you want to tell on somebody. The other time that you have to debrief is back in the early 2000s. One of the criteria for leaving SMU2 was you had to either renounce or debrief your gang membership. The laws have changed since then, protecting the inmate, because at that time, DOC putting you in that situation was actually putting you in a death threat situation. And people filed lawsuits behind it, families filed lawsuits behind it.
I understand why you raise that as being something.
Well, it's not part of the criteria now. Debriefing is not part of the criteria to enter the step down program. What is part of the criteria is a polygraph test.
Okay.
Which I told you, and I took the polygraph test in 2011, and I passed it then.
So if this board were to release you, that has nothing to do with your debriefing at all. That would be something that the board ought not to even consider.
Debriefing is no longer in our language, DOC-wise, court-wise, or otherwise, unless the inmate wants, say for instance that an inmate wants to what they call TC here. TC stands for protective custody. If an inmate wants to go to a staff member and says, hey, I want protective custody, they'll pull you out, and then they have staff here called SSU. They specialize in that area. They'll come and they'll check you and they'll say, hey, what's the problem? This is my problem. Okay, well, you understand that in order for us to advance you in protective custody, to make sure that you're doing it for the right reasons, we want you to debrief. And then they can agree at that time to debrief or just renounce. Renounce means that you're just leaving the gang membership and you're moving on to wherever they put renounces at.
Okay, so I think I understand. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you so much,
okay.
Sir.
Thank you, Honorable Board Chairman. Yes, Mr. Johnson.
Sir, I understand. I hear what you're saying about not debriefing, but I'm having a little problem just really understanding the issue of not debriefing. And you said you wasn't involved in any gang when this incident occurred, but you were a little more than a year left before your minimum release date when you committed this crime. With a little more than a year left before your minimum release date, I'm just not understanding what encouraged you to commit this crime. You saying it was just your pride, but you weren't prepared to get into any STG at that time because you were just getting there. But you had just about a little over a year, and you would have been almost problem free.
Sure, that is true. I should have went home 9 months ago, 31 years ago. That's an absolute fact. At that time, there was no STG. There was no security threat group. There was no SMU2. There has always been gangs in Arizona, at least in the prison system. But there was nothing in the laws that the state uses today called STG back then.
Okay.
So at that time, there was no such thing as debriefing, renouncing. There was only protective custody. And the way that an inmate would enter protective custody was to state so, and then he would tell staff why he's going in there. Hey, Billy Bob came up to me, threatened my life, or he wants me to sell drugs, and I don't want to.
So
I want protection.
Sir,
and they would remove you from the yard.
Listen to me. I understand what you're saying and explaining about the SDG. What I'm trying to understand is that you had, you would have been released in a year if you had not gotten involved in this crime, but you chose to commit a crime that you knew was going to extend your sentence much longer than what you already had, but you say that it was not because of any gang affiliation, that you were not trying to get involved. And I'm just trying to picture that and understand that, you know, a year and a half before you're going to be released, and then you get involved in an incident that causes you to spend 20 25 to 30 more years in prison, and you know that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, if I understand the question correctly, because I can barely hear you, is at that time, I absolutely made a bad decision. I think that the atmosphere in the prison system, the violence, the attitude of violence begets violence, that everything in here is resolved through violence. If an act of violence is perpetrated upon you, you don't tell a CO, you don't run and hide, you act out accordingly, and as prison dictates. Prison politics back then was violence, well, I mean, I guess it is today. Prison, violence begets violence. I don't want to minimize or make excuses for my actions. I absolutely acted out in a way that I absolutely regret.
So what was the violent act that was committed against you that you had to react in that type of manner?
A hot cup of coffee was thrown in my face.
And that was it?
How was it thrown in my face?
No, I said that was it, the hot cup of coffee. I heard you say that earlier. The hot cup of coffee.
Well, even now today, if something happens on the yard and the yard is locked down, it's what the yard calls hard lockdown. Whenever that happens, inmates, they have to feed inmates, the staff has to feed inmates in their cells. At that time, 30 years ago, inmates could feed the inmates. Today, staff do it. But back then, inmates did it. I walked up to my food truck, and I told you back then there was a lot of racial warring going on between the races. Whites on blacks, Mexicans on blacks, blacks on Mexicans, so on and so forth. And when I walked up to my trap to get my food tray, I was hit in the face with a hot cup of coffee. This was at breakfast. It was 5 in the morning, and I was hit in the face with a hot cup of coffee.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay.
Any further questions? Okay, seeing no questions right now from fellow board members, I'm going to go ahead and ask if Mr. Beryl Duran's supporter, Mr. Leroy Arisaga?
Yes.
Yeah, Arisaga.
Arisaga. Mr. Arisaga, would you like to approach the podium? And this is a choice, by the way, you don't have to speak.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And if you'll state your name for the record.
My name is Leroy Arisaga.
And what would you like to share with the board, sir?
I wrote a letter. I don't know if I need to read it or if you guys have already read it.
Well, we certainly have received letters that were attached to the parole packet, but if you think it'll help clarify or give you a place to start from.
Okay, well, I'll just kind of go off of my letter, basically, what I wrote to you. So basically, again, I've known Miguel since I was 12 years old. I've been a lifelong friend of Miguel. Pretty much have supported him since he's gone here day one. My family as well has been there for support for him. My father, as he said, is a deacon in the Catholic Church and is a retired principal. He lives alone in his own house, and he too has known Guy since for like 30, 40 years as well. My dad's offered to let him stay there. He has a three-bedroom house, and I have the opportunity to present Michael with an apprenticeship to learn carpentry in the construction field. The company I work for, I've been with for 10 years. I'm the general superintendent, and we employ 200 employees. So I have enough pull in the company that they would give him a chance to learn some skills this late in his life. Typically, we look for the younger guys, but being that he's a family member, I would bring him in and teach him some knowledgeable skills that he can make a decent living to support himself and make it. I mean, coming in to the job, we would start him at $14 an hour. And he has potential to make up to $30 an hour. Learning the skills, he says he has a problem with math. My dad's a school teacher, so we would help him learn some measurements. And that's what he would need. He would need to learn some measurements and to be a framer. My company, We are currently on multiple projects, projects as big as 30-story sky rises, 15-story sky rises. We have a lot of potential to teach them some skills in life. On that note, vehicle-wise, I have a vehicle that's been parked on the side of my house for 10 years that I saved just in case I need it for my own job, but I'm supplied with a vehicle. I would give him a vehicle to get by once he got his driver's license and got on his feet. So he has transportation, he would have a house, he would have a job. With just all that in place, he's off to a running start. As soon as he gets out, he can start working immediately the day he's released, or once he checks in with his parole officer and gets permission and whatnot. So coming home, he's only been there 30 years. He's been there all his life, pretty much. If you guys would grant him the opportunity to come home, I promise you that I would do my best to make sure that he is successful. And I know that he has learned and grown a lot because I have been with him on this journey for 30 years. I send him money, you know, for his birthday and for Christmas every year, and have for the last 30 years. If he needs any help, I've always been there to help him. And I plan on continuing to be there for him as a support system. He has nobody left in this world. Everybody's gone. But he does have me and my family. Like I said, I've never been in prison. I've never been in trouble. I try to be a good example to a lot of people in the community. I've been a martial artist since I was 5 years old. And I competed in Muay Thai kickboxing and retained 4 championship belts. So my dedication to respect and to teach has always been there. It's a part of my life. And with Miguel coming home, he would have me support him, which is strong background bone for him, and I can only just ask that we give him the opportunity to come out. Yes, sir.
Yeah, can I ask you a question? And as always, I'll try to be delicate because some of these questions can be sensitive. You've known him for a very long time. It sounds like you have a really strong family unit. You know, you mentioned your father and your success in the private industry, which, I mean, this is not your hearing, but we do commend you for that. Considering how he became involved in drug trafficking when he was young and what has happened inside the prison system, why do you think he can safely be transitioned back to the community now, in your opinion?
I think when you're young, you make bad decisions. But as you sit there and you marinate on your thought and what you did wrong and what you missed out on, you absorb all that and you take it into your acknowledgement that, hey, there's life behind after you get out from prison. You can make a life. Talking to the guy and always being on the telephone with him and listening to his anticipation and what can I do? I can't wait till I get out. And I've always told him, hey, brother, you're going to be 53, 54, 55. Who knows how old? You're going to be an older gentleman. But if you let me, I will give you what you need to do. And he's been on board ever since day one. I mean, he's been there 30 years. It's a long time. You know, when he's during your 20s, you do stupid things. Like, everybody's done dumb things at one time or another. And I know for a fact that he's grown up. His faith is strong in God. He's a really smart man. He's very educated. He's smart. He's good with people, talking to people. And I know that he can be successful at her.
Again, with that same sensitivity, and I'll ask him directly too, because I don't mean to try to poke you for information that I could ask him directly. And I'm not asking this question as some sort of excuse for somebody's behavior, but do you think he had a rough childhood?
Absolutely.
I will say, go as far as saying traumatic.
I
have a reason for this, by the way, why I'm asking these questions.
I would say that, yeah, he had a pretty rough childhood, and
this is an interesting thing to bring up. I'm not a clinician, not a psychologist, I don't want to diagnose anyone, but I've seen this pattern very much, and that is individuals who are traumatized as children often have highly developed learning areas in their developmental skills, and I can tell he's well read. I can tell that he's a very well read, you said he was a smart individual, and he's struggling with math. And I've seen that pattern over and over again. And it has to do with linear thought, I won't go on and on. But I can't help but notice that he's a very intelligent individual. He's talking about struggling with math. And I've seen that pattern with people who carry trauma from their childhood. So I was just curious. And I'll ask him again.
Yes, sir.
I'll ask my fellow members, is there any questions for you? Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Bertrand?
Yes.
We're getting close to the end of your hearing. Is there a final statement you'd like to make to the board before we go into discussion?
Yeah, I guess that I would just like to state that as you heard Mr. Arasaga speak, he's grounded. What he left out of his conversation is he's the president of a car club. He owned his own gym. He owned his own company before he went full-time into the endeavors he's in, he's connected with today. His father is well-grounded. If Mr. Villa is there with you, he's also a dear friend of mine. He's an ordained minister as well. He's been an absolute example in my life of a person that can make the type of mistakes that I made and changed his life and transformed his life. His mother, I was adopted out as a kid. I wasn't raised by my mom because my mom was, for lack of better words, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I could tell in Mr. Agassi's voice that he was a little leery on going there, and so was I. Basically that was the case when I was raised by my grandmother, off and on. But I also lived with Mr. Villa, and for 15 years in prison, family did come to see me. Mr. Hill's mother, she came to see me every Saturday, four times a month, for 15 years. They have chairs that you can sit down and visit with the inmate. She never sat down, she stood up. She came to see me in 2007, went home and had a stroke and died. That was the last time I got to see her. For 15 years, that's the kind of friends I have. They opened up their own homes, their own families to me, to create a family around me. They have far exceeded what anybody deserves, especially someone like me. But they've been there for me. They haven't given up on me, and they're the ones that have given me hope. They have given me opportunity to succeed, and I don't want to let them down. I don't want to say that, I don't want to let you guys down because that's a cliche. I don't want to let myself down. One of the gentlemen there, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, was hard on the debriefing area. I've made a determination with both Mr. V and Mr. Albasari can attest to. I have a tattoo on my body, and there's only one way that you can get that tattoo. And there's only one way out of the gang. You can either leave, or you can remove that tattoo. I'm going to remove my tattoo. That's a fact. Rig, regardless if it's today or whenever I get out of this place, when I sit before my parole officer, I'm going to talk to him about where do I go to get this removed. That's what I'm going to do. That's the burden I have to bear, but that's nobody's fault but mine. I put myself in that situation, now I have to deal with the consequences, but I'm prepared to. But more than that, I have friends that are prepared to help me make this adjustment, to make that decision, because I can't do it by myself. But with them helping me, with them affording me all of the privileges that they're opening up to me, I know that I have a greater chance of succeeding. I don't have family left, like a blood. I don't have blood left. I kind of wish my stepfather was here to speak up for me. He was only married to my mother for 13 years while I was a kid. But he stayed in my life, and he was one of the other guys that used to come to see me and called me son, and I referred to him as dad, even though he was not legally my dad. And back when he was legally my dad, I never referred to him as dad. I called him Lupe, because that was his name. But I learned to respect him. I learned to appreciate him. And I kind of wish he was here to speak on my behalf today, because you guys would have liked him. He was a Vietnam vet, and he was a good man. He made a lot of mistakes, but he also was in law enforcement. But he was a good guy. But anyhow, with that said, I thank you guys for your time. I understand you guys do what you have to do, and you guys have a great responsibility. Not sounding cliche, I just want you to know that I know you've heard it a thousand times, and you hear it every day. I don't want to be a statistic. I want to be a success story. And I absolutely want to succeed. And I'm not saying that for you, for them. I'm saying that because Mr. Beltran, I, Miguel, want to succeed. I'm tired of living a life that has been fruitless, a life of futility. There's no reward in this no more. I've been at it far longer than humanly possible. I'm telling you, most people go bananas. My counselor was just telling me today, I don't know how you did it. Well, I don't know how I did it either, but by the grace of God, I'm still here. I have my sanity. I have all my faculties. Again, my heart's beating. You know, my mind is alert. I'm strong. I'm healthy. And I'm prepared to if given the opportunity to get back into society and become a working part of society and a taxpayer. These are areas that I haven't done in 30-plus years, and I want to get back to being human again, if that's possible. I plan on programming completely. This is something I was talking to my CO3 about. Regardless of what I have to do because of parole, I already have plans on getting into some type of psychological counseling to make sure that I can transition back into the free world and be not only healthy for myself and for my friends and their family, but healthy as productive in society. If you had asked me 15, 20 years ago, I would have never admitted this, but I believe that I've become institutionalized, and that's scary. You guys knowing the system pretty much knows the system is pretty mundane. You know, when to get up, when to go to bed, when to eat, all that stuff. And I want to make sure that my mind is clear, that my mind is healthy, and that I'm on the right track. And I've took a lot of counseling, as you stated, so, and it's not just me going through the measures. I've absolutely had every opportunity to exercise some of the skills that I've learned in here. Even again, on behalf of DW Ochoa in Tucson, she started a mentoring class, and I entered that mentoring class, mentoring other inmates. I had an opportunity on four occasions, and it felt good. I kind of found where I wanted to be. I wanted to be on the other side where I can tell somebody, hey, look, I know what you've been through. I've been there, done that, and this is how I've done it, and this is how I succeeded, if given that opportunity to succeed. And if not given that opportunity, again, I know you guys' job, and I know it's a hard job. You guys are responsible for the public safety as well as the prison safety. I've been given the tools by the Department of Corrections to succeed, and I've taken every opportunity to do so on my behalf, at least to what the system that I'm currently in is affords us as inmates. And and I've graduated just about everything that you can do in this lockdown and on the open room. And lastly, I would just say this, that I continue to work as I speak to you. I have a job. One of the things that my stepfather did instill in me was a good work ethic. I just lost sight of that. I wasn't thinking, and I tried to find an easy way out. But I do have a good work ethic. I guess that would be all. And I just thank you guys for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeron. The board will be going into discussion now. It may sound like we're speaking with you directly, especially because this may be your first time, at least in recent days, before the board. But it is the board discussing the case amongst itself under the open meeting laws of Arizona. So if you'll just remain on the phone, we'll come back to you shortly with a decision. And also a reminder, we don't discuss these cases before we come into the hearing room. So this is all original dialogue, if you will. Okay, sir?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The board is now in discussion. Fellow board members, this is a very interesting case. And I will say, as one voting board member, I plan to keep the message pretty positive regardless of where the votes land today. The reason why I say this is because he's very early in his parole eligibility cycle. And that does not always mean an automatic transition to parole. We look very hard at the totality of the case and where somebody's at in their development before we make that consideration, because certainly, as I've said many times, but I know that we've all said it, we have some very hard decisions to make on behalf of the people of Arizona, in special regard to public safety, as to whether or not we can safely transition an individual who's been inside the prison system for a very long period and productive transition to the community, often graduated. I will begin by saying that I'm certainly impressed with his programming, his journey, if you will, and I guess the question is whether or not at this particular juncture, whether or not he's quite ready to make the transition to the community. And I think this is a really important case for the discussion, and that's where I'll begin it. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Well, Mr. Quinones, thank you. I actually worked for the Department of Corrections at the time of this incident, and I remember the incident. Based on my memory of what happened and the information that I've read in the file, my discussion today with Mr. Bergeron, I could not at this point support any sort of community release, but I'll certainly listen to input of other board members.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. Mr. Johnson? Mr. Neal?
Well, I'm impressed with his presentation and everything, but I agree with what you're saying about early in the process, early into the eligibility for parole. I think that to be supportive of like a home resident, I'd want to have probably a definite location for him to be housed. I mean, that's something that, you know, ABC has approved already. I also think that a halfway house initially would be a better place for placement than an individual residence, just because of the difficulties of transition and the more available program to a halfway house. So at this time, I wouldn't be supportive of relief, but I would be supportive of not using it in your setup.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. And I will follow up on that, too, because you brought up something that I was thinking about as well, and that is, I recognize that he has a plan, so I don't want to suggest that there was no reference to a place to live, per se, but I think firm acceptance into a halfway house and a little bit more detail as to some of his living arrangements in the future, when we consider this, I think would certainly be helpful. I don't want to say that would, I don't want to make any false promises, but, and I think the other thing as well is that it looks like that he's been in a good period, and I want to continue this, I'd like to see him continue on this path. But he's been able to maintain a good discipline record since 2012. The 2013 incident looks like that it was resolved, but still, it's good to see a pretty firm period of time without discipline as an indication of where they're at in their development. But just adding that. Dr. Wright, do you have anything?
I think that, where we are is this is the beginning of his stay through in recent years. I know he came to this board some years ago, but I think where we are now, I think that I'm not in favor at this time, sir. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. I'm going to go ahead and make a motion and see where the votes land. And that is for Mr. Miguel Bellatoran, ABC number 076611. My motion is to deny regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. And I think I am going to go with the 1 year set off, but I'm certainly open to input on that.
I agree with this.
Okay. So, again, let me be specific, and then we'll get to the reasons in a second. Again, my motion is to not deny regular parole, absolute discharge of home arrest with a 1 year set off.
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Rittenhouse, agreed upon by Dr. Wright, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Neal. Again, for the page one release type denied once again is a 412A411HA. And the reasons for denial is followed. And I certainly look to the support of my colleagues if I'm missing something. Certainly a serious and violent offense. Trauma to the victim. And pardon me, maybe I got a little blurry there in the story. The victim was not killed, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, so let me make sure she didn't get that
serious
incorrect.
Serious bodily injury, though.
But yes, serious bodily injury. I think there's a history of assaultive behavior inside the criminal. I'm sorry, inside corrections. Prior criminal history. I'll be careful on this one. We didn't really get into the details. There were some narcotics violations inside the correction system. Does anyone have a strong opinion of whether or not we should check continued substance abuse? Or we just take a pass on that?
It doesn't appear to have worried since way back a ways. I mean, there aren't any disciplines since like 97 that have to do with drugs.
Poor institutional behavior, to be sure, at least in the early incarceration up until 2012. Would we consider 2012 recent?
No. 5 years.
What's that?
More than 5 years.
It's more than 5 years, okay. Good programming. He has a good release plan, or at least he's working on developing a very strong one. Very good demeanor during the hearing. I don't want that to be lost. He does have support from the community. I recognize he mentioned that he had low family support at this point. Anything in the other category? Okay, Mr. Barrel-Turan?
Yes.
As you've heard in the discussion, this is your first time for consideration for regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. The board has unanimously voted to deny it at this stage. But as the panel chairman, I certainly want to end this hearing with encouragement. This is not your last time before the board. You're early in your eligibility for parole, and we look to see more development from you. We know you're working hard. We're not dismissing that. But at this point, we are denying regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. Do you have any questions for us?
No, not a question. I would just like to say something if I can.
Sir, if you'll keep it short, yes.
Yeah, just so that you're aware, because I'm under the old code, the old 13604, and I'll be seeing you guys in another 6 months, just so you guys are aware, if I get out, even at that time, I will be on my lifetime parole. I won't be paroled, you know, a year, 6 months, or 2 years. I'm on my lifetime parole, and that can only be changed by the courts. And so I just wanted you guys to know that.
Thank you, sir. And please understand, I mean, we can make no promises as to what's going to happen before you appear before a board early, but we will look very hard at your case, and we will be very fair.
Okay.
So thank you for being so pleasant with the board today, and we look forward to meeting with you again. And at this point, I think I will end the hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.